Pianist Monty Alexander with Bob Marley's Crazy Ballheads. So we've had two Jamaicans on the program just like that, and musically wonderful too. This is Lead Stories. I am Utrice Lead. It's Tuesday, April the 9th, the day before the big budget, and it's open forums right here. It's your show. You get to tell me and others what's on your mind, raising the issues you think are important, things that you think deserve closer attention. The number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Well, of course, there's so much to talk about, but it's, as I say, in Hollywood, it's not about me, it's about you. So what do you think about me? And if it weren't so awful, we'd almost just lay down and die right here. I mean, just a crazy coming together of all kinds of things. So you get to dictate it today. Let's see where you're going. Take us on your journey. 888-874-4888. One of the things that we have to do is continue the business of cross-pollinating, and that is take ideas from wherever they come and start dissecting them and develop a talent, if you will, or the skill of making a point, even if people disagree or even if you disagree with other people. Make your point. This is something I must say the opposition does quite well. They engage in debate, even if people disagree with them. They don't care. But as long as they make their point, and if you respect the integrity of an idea, that is the greatest kind of connection to have. So the cross-pollinating of ideas. There's so many things that have been occurring and swirling around us, and I'm imagining that you have your own takes and your own ideas about what it is we ought to be paying closer attention to. And you can offer, as competent as anybody else, an analysis. Sarah, hello, good afternoon to you.
Greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you.
Well, Utrice, it was a very interesting show on yesterday, and I was so glad that you decided you were going to have open forum again on today.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. What I wanted to mention was on this situation here that's going on, these distractions that are being thrown out in the media, and we, as emotional people, we seem to be falling for it, the gay rights issue, the gun control issue, while in the meantime, we are seeing what's this budget proposal that's being brewing in the background that we are not staying focused on. Also, the skirmishes that's going on in Asia, as well as the so-called Middle East with North Korea and Iran. So we are being juggled like balls in the air, and we are not focusing on the things that are most important to us. Gay rights issue is not going to really affect us in the pocketbook more so than what's being proposed with this budget that is being pushed through this Congress.
But do you say then that the issue is not as important simply because it isn't affiliated or isn't associated as we think of it with money, but it actually is, you know?
Yeah, I know it is affiliated with money.
The same-sex issue is very much a money issue.
I know it is a money issue, Yatrice, and these people have lobbied and put themselves in a very key position in order to be where they are, the proponents of this issue. But what I'm seeing with us for right now, our immediate concern is what is being proposed, these slashes that are being done that is going to affect your entitlement benefits, things that doesn't have nothing to do with the budget, that is not even a part of the deficit that is being attacked.
All right, let's reconstruct a little bit here, Sarah.
Yes, ma'am.
Working, what I'm trying to get at is not necessarily to approach things in order of priority, because that too is a distraction, because everything needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And the gay rights issue is as important as the budget issue, because we have to look back historically. When African Americans were pressing for civil rights, everybody said, hey, there's stuff that's much more important than that. You have to take a back seat because we have other issues to deal with. You know, why should the country stop just because you have a problem sitting where you want to sit on a bus or getting a hotel room or booking an airline ticket or something? You know, why should we get upset? So for people in movement, the way you think movement-wise is, that's a struggle. They are clearly waging an effective war on that struggle. But it's not supposed to be, we are not supposed to look at it in terms of priority to say, well, because I think such and such, this therefore is a higher priority than somebody else's fight. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, ma'am.
ma'am, I'm only 22. what I'm trying to say is every struggle for a right is a priority struggle. You see?
Yes, I do agree with you. Yeah, it is a priority struggle, Yatrice. But what I'm saying with what's going on with us is that we are losing focus because these people are throwing everything to see whichever one sticks.
Correct. Now, I just want the satisfaction of knowing that you have reframed the subject, you see. And I think
you did
a fantastic job. Great. So now tell me about why you think this is, and you're right, you're dead right on it. Why do you think that all of these other things that are happening around, the issues that you see are really important, that they are designed to deflect attention?
Because what they're going to do, they're playing on us emotionally. When they're going to slip this thing through, this budget through, and do all of these slashings, and when it's a done deal, we are going to be so busy worrying about a war in Korea and people going over there and Iran and all of these other things. And these underhanded things are being done, and it's going to be a done deal. Just like with the pipeline situation that was already sneaked into that bill and it's already done, a lot of us are not even aware that that is already a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the things that they do to sneak you in. You're busy worrying about the gay issue. I'm opposed to it because I feel like Yatrice, that our civil rights struggle has been corrupted and it has been turned into something other than what it is that has benefited everyone more so than it has benefited black people. But on that again, we need to look and see what they're going to do on these immediate pocketbook issue, because a lot of people who are entitled, who are receiving these entitlements, there are a lot of so-called white people who call themselves middle class, who thought they were middle class, who are now going to find themselves slashed. They're going to be living out of their cars. They're going to be going down to the aid office to receive aid, and there's going to be no aid for them to sign up to get.
Are you listening to your? If you're listening to yourself, you are pointing us in a direction that you haven't quite stated. What do you think that might be? You have all these pockets of resistance and all these issues that are, in effect, diluting our attention. Framed another way, what do you see the potential here to be? What is the potential in this situation that we're in?
What I see the situation is right now, Eutrice, is what is going on.
The opportunity and potential in the situation.
The potential right now is for them to completely slash all of these so-called programs that were put in place to benefit individuals. These are what
but
they
on
want
the to- other side, think on the other side, from the people's side, what is the opportunity and what is the potential? You're right on it.
The opportunity for the people is for us to mobilize like we did before and not to sit down.
You go. That's the whole, that's the secret right there. You're saying it. And you see what I mean? You're saying it.
Yes, ma'am.
You're seeing it. And this is the missed opportunity that is going on. And this is the work that people have to do. We have to find ways. And there was a time when we did find ways. There was a time when we were able to set aside what we considered to be the distractions and concentrate on harnessing all the energy. You put the gay people together with the budget people, together with the housing people, together with the unemployment people. You know, all this energy needs to be galvanized.
Mm-hmm.
You are brilliant, Sarah of Dallas.
Well, thank you, Miss Eutrice. I do appreciate the compliment.
Thank you so much. Patricia
of
New York.
Ma'am.
Thank you. Hello, Patricia. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Eutrice, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
You know, I was last night, half of America, or I think most of America, was transfixed to the television watching the NCAA basketball final. And while I did not watch it, my thought was about those 13 young men on the floor, 10 of whom were boys of color, black and brown. And Louisville has a graduation rate less than 50% for their athletes in not 4 years, not 5 years, but 6 years. Now, the coach of that team, Rick Pitino, his base salary is $5 million a year, and he's certainly going to get a bonus for not just getting to the final, but actually winning. And I thought about what happens to these boys who, for 2 hours last night, were exhilarated. Less than half of them are going to graduate with a degree. And I don't hear anyone talking about their education and their future and their growth potential and their earning potential and their ability to be productive and constructive in society.
That's very profound. That is a very profound observation, and it happens to be true. We see... It's a kind of plantation system, for lack of a better term.
It is absolutely a plantation system, which is why, if you notice, whenever the discussion comes about paying these young men, nobody wants them to get paid, but at the same time, they don't want them to, they will not get a good education, they will not graduate with any skills, they won't graduate at all, much less graduate with skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, in so many ways, it is happening in so many industries, and the athletic industry is just rife with this kind of a problem, because when you look at it, really, it really truly is a plantation system. You have these young people with incredible athletic prowess, and that is all that they're valued for, their ability to perform on the basketball court, because key to their performance is what?
Money.
Patricia? Money! They bring in tons and tons of money. And they don't share in it, of course. And their educational futures are not the number one priority. They are just cogs in a wheel. And it should they, like the other day when this young man shattered his leg, one person will come back in and fill that spot.
Absolutely.
No, it's just a recurring syndrome. So let me ask you, as I would ask Sarah, your analysis is very profound. What do you see as a possible lesson here, or something that could work that might turn things in a different direction?
Well, I think there has to be some recognition on the part of parents when they send their children off to school that, in fact, their number one priority should be guaranteeing them an education.
Yes. Let's take it on two levels. Tell me about the industry itself. What responsibility does the industry have, and it's particularly those athletes who had gone through the system and who should have a particular point of view about this?
Well, here again, if you look at what has happened at Rutgers, the whistleblower at Rutgers, who is a person of color, rather than being lauded for being the whistleblower, is now being investigated by the FBI.
Yes.
Because, in fact, he made a valiant attempt to raise this as an issue with Rutgers administration. And everybody is now backtracking and saying, well, I didn't know, I didn't see the video, what did I know and when did I know it, when in fact everyone was aware, but they were so focused on the $40 million that they were going to get by going to the Big Ten, that everybody is now blaming him and saying that he was attempting to extort. So the question is, what happens and what protection does one have when one raises the issue?
Okay. Supposedly, I mean, under the whistleblower law, he's supposed to be protected by the whistleblower law.
But we also know that that is not foolproof and that does not protect one.
Exactly. What I'm thinking is this. There ought to be some kind of an advocacy situation within, call it like a watchdog group made up especially of former college athletes whose very opinions about these things ought to matter in the industry. And there ought to be a commitment, an absolute legal commitment by the college to provide these young men with everything they need to succeed academically. Not in the fake sense where a professor gives you an A and you don't have to go to class, but to be absolutely on top of the issues of whether they're being exploited, whether they're being treated fairly, and so forth. The third thing is, you know, the parents themselves are really struggling in a kind of a vacuum. I mean, things are so complicated, ordinary people just can't cope with the complexities of things that they encounter. So they have to be schooled. It's the same thing, like one of the things in the Central Park case, I'll just give you an analogy here. When this just happened, the Central Park case where the woman was raped and they rounded up all these young men, they went to the homes of these young men and just took them out. And many of the parents just let them go. It turns out, of course, that they were not at all guilty of anything. But my point being, of course, the parents in hindsight now have 20/20 vision, but just not knowing what to do at the very instant when a decision could have made a tremendous difference in their lives and in the outcomes for them.
But, you know, Eutrice, while I agree with you that there needs to be some advocacy on the part of former players who have gone through these programs and who have experienced what these boys are going to experience, I agree with you. But the problem is when their ball career is over, they want their next job. And most of them want – and their next job is usually in broadcasting or in licensing agreements. And nobody wants to be the – nobody wants to be the one to have their stuff messed up. So no one is interested in guiding, in being the mentor and guiding them, and you know, as to what to do and what not to do, because everybody wants their next paycheck.
Well, Patricia, I thank you for bringing a very good story that should serve as a program idea. Thank you very much for
that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. From the People's Democratic Republic of Brooklyn, we have Marilyn. Marilyn, are you there? Is Marilyn with us?
I'm on a military base, so I'm...
Hello. You're not Marilyn. Who are you?
Very, very well. I'm
tell me who you are. I didn't get your name.
Oh, yeah. My name's Frank.
Hello. That's a big difference between Marilyn and Frank. Frank, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Maryland.
Maryland, thank you, and welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. So what are you sharing with us today?
Well, what I'm called to talk about was the Atlanta testing scandal and just some of the underlying things that were going on. The things that I wanted to talk about were the role that student discipline and respect play in it, teacher qualification, kids being tracked, and basically how this all works into one thing. In this
all right,
day,
so proceed with it. Tell us the story.
What was that?
Tell us, frame it for us and now give us the whole thing in one picture.
Okay. I think one of the big problems with education is the student discipline and respect. And, a lot of blame goes on teachers for the problem with students not being tested and other things. And really, if the students aren't, let me make this caveat. People talk about teacher qualifications. Teachers are more qualified than they've ever been. Now, I keep remembering George Bush when he said something like, teachers ought to be tested before you go in the classroom. Since the 70s, teachers have had to pass and states have their own versions of this in every state in the union. They also have to go to classes and professional development on a daily basis and a yearly basis, and by a certain time of teaching, you have to have a master's degree. Now, what's really in danger here is that there are groups in counties that track students' progress from the third grade in order to determine how many jails to build into a given community.
So I talked about that just yesterday.
This is extremely, extremely important, and it's extremely devastating, particularly for children of color. The idea that Atlanta, which is a majority black town, having these discipline problems, I think that's one of the major contributors. If the students are not having to pay attention in class, then it's going to be very hard to teach them and for them to retain what the teacher is trying to give to them. And we have lots of teaching techniques, lots of different things, ways of making the lessons more engaging, but the students are not listening. And I just talked to a young man who was in the hallway, and when I tried to talk to him about it, I got, of course, disrespect. This is something that during my father's time, probably during your time, during my time, was unacceptable and was not tolerated in any way, shape, or form. Whereas now students are getting away with this in school buildings, in high schools, teachers are being attacked. And this is the environment we're trying to fight to save children.
All right.
Something is not done about that, we're going to, not going to children every day.
Well, you're kind of breaking up a little bit, but I got the essence of what you're saying. Let me ask you, because this is a legitimate issue. Many teachers have complained about the discipline problem in their schools. And there is, on the flip side of that, there are many teachers who complain about discipline simply because they do not really want to teach the children. They just want them to kind of just go away and leave them alone. They're not interested in interacting with the children. But what, therefore, is an appropriate way to deal with the undisciplined student?
That's an interesting question. It's an interesting question because the answer I'm going to give, I think that these days and this society, people are not going to want to agree, are going to want to deal with it. But I think that in certain states, 17 states, they still do it. But I do think that paddling is appropriate, particularly on the elementary and middle school levels. And it should be something that is strictly dealt with from the standpoint of administering and having a team of administrators who actually typically do so that everybody is given the same assignment. This is something that during my dad's time, during integration, was not an issue. During integration, we had white schools, black schools, everybody paddled. Everybody did, up to high school even. And my dad went to a school in Sarasota where during integration, his school had the highest scores on the state test time in his county. So much so that the school board came down, took over the school, and re-administered the test, at which these black children scored even higher in a situation where the kids were extremely disciplined and were strictly in this type of...
Oh, Frank, you're breaking up terribly. We're trying to hear you, but you're breaking up. But I think this is an issue. I think people have to come to some degree. There are people within the teaching community, I'm sure, who have come up with some kind of a method, or the union, certainly, union teachers union. Does the teachers union have a proposed way of dealing with undisciplined children?
No, they have not. But really what they do is they tell you basically to placate, to use games and things like that to make the classroom more interesting. And of course, teachers are implementing this.
That's not enough, you know, because...
Exactly, not even close.
No, it's not enough. There has to be some kind of a method.
There has to be a consequence to their actions, which now, sadly, there is no consequence to actions. The worst thing that can happen to a student is that they're being referred and taken out of school for that, but that doesn't solve the problem, because at some point that student's going to come back, and if the behavior is not dealt with at home by the parents, then that student's going to have the same problem. And
right.
So it's over and over and over again. So this
well,
is going to have to
I
be
think,
dealt with.
I think that you just have to raise it within the context of the union, because teachers need directives on what to do. Why? Because disciplining is a legal issue. It could mushroom into a legal issue. And there ought to be clear, there ought to be some kind of a paper trail, there ought to be a method, there ought to be a process around how an undisciplined child is dealt with. And I suspect one of the things that you might want to do is to ask around. Somebody in some school district must have a process of dealing with an undisciplined child that protects the teacher. Because, you see, you know, this is, as you know, the very litigious society. When a teacher takes on the task of disciplining, your method may be different from Jenny's method, which may be different from Mary's method. And all three of you may be held to a legal standard, and it could, you know, result in, it could backfire is what I'm saying. So it seems to me that there ought to be some kind of models out there. Maybe the National Association of Black School Educators and Administrators, maybe some organization has a recommendation as to how this is done. It needs to be made an issue. It needs to result in training and seminars and whatnot. This is an educational process for the teacher, because this happens again. This is a reflection of how ill-prepared the process is of teaching. A teacher is held to a whole bunch of standards. The teacher is not there just to impart information and educate a child. The teacher is also legally responsible for the safety of the child while in the teacher's custody in the classroom. So all these things, I think, will have to come into play. So maybe through your union, Frank, you have to insist that there be some kind of process delineated about how discipline is done.
Yeah, personally, I think it has to be the job of the administrator. It has to be. It always historically has been the job of the administrator, but the administrator's hands a lot of times are tied. I don't think that teachers individually should have the right to discipline students physically in that manner, but I do think that the principal or a team that administers those types of things, that way it can be administered the same across the board. It's not this person over here, it's that person over there. It's this particular group of people who are administrators, who are trained, is going to administer this discipline. It doesn't have to be paddling, but it has to be something that the students respect. Because right now, the students don't respect the discipline that's being done in schools. And that is a big part of the problem.
I think this is an issue that needs to be raised at the union level. And the administrators, their management, for lack of a better term, you have to approach it from the union perspective as a person who's basically you're on the firing line. You are in the trenches. So your perspective has to be as uniform as any other teacher's perspective. And this is a key element of what you need to be effective in the classroom. You have to have a process. In the same way you have lesson plans and you have all these component parts, you also have to have a process for discipline. So I would urge that you tackle it at that level. Thank you for joining us today, Frank, and thank you for your contribution. We go to Miami next, where we meet Flory. Hello, Flory.
Hi, Trent. Thank you so much for the show.
Thank you.
I want to bring up a topic, staying in the school topic, but before I bring that up, I want to mention that a lot of times, not always, the discipline or the behavior, they start as simple as what we are feeding our kids. I have been in my child's school doing volunteer hours, and I have sat in the table when they have lunch, and I have been in the class helping the teacher for my volunteer hours that is required in the charter, and I have seen how after the sugary desserts they get, the whole class is out of control opposed to the morning when they first started. And nobody even makes the link that it could be also the sugar. I mean, when I make birthday parties and I see how these kids behave after the cake, we always go to the pool after because they are out of control. So I am not saying that that's the answer, but it's something that could start at home. My daughter always tells me what their friends eat at school, and I am amazed that they can even sit and concentrate after that. You know, after a Nutella, a croissant, and chocolate chip cookies and a soda. Mm-hmm. And I am sure this has an impact on the discipline. But this to be targeted at so many levels of awareness, and many people are not even willing to look into that. And all what you need to do is go to a supermarket and see what the families fill up the cart with. I am amazed because I'm very health-oriented in terms of what I feed my child. So that's one thing. The other topic that I wanted to bring up that I see, at least in the school of my child, is a lot of peer pressure on having every single electronic toy in the market. Any given kid at the age of 9 has an iPhone 5. The 4 is given away already. Most adults don't need an iPhone 5. They have an iPad. They have all the Apple toys, a video camera, TV with the most sophisticated box game. And the kids that don't have that, that's not the case with my kid. I teach her different values. But I have friends of my child that the mothers talk to me about this, the type of pressure the kids are putting because of the peer pressure, and they feel less than if they don't get that. My friend bought $160 pair of shoes to her boy because the whole class was paying. I don't pay $100 for my shoes, you know? So this is a lot of values that at least I see in the charter school where there is a little bit of a higher-end population in Aventura, Miami, and it is a concern that I have. And in terms of the diet, when I approach the principal to try to bring a solution for the food that is given at school, and my kid is forbidden to eat at school, I gave her food from home, she answered me that to be grateful that at least the food was kosher, and that's good enough. And wow. There is not many places that I can really touch with my influences, which I don't have. And it's something that really concerns me, I must say.
Well, you know, a lot of this has to do with contracts and food suppliers winning contracts to supply the various schools with the food. Mm-hmm. And this is a political decision. It is rife with corruption. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, it doesn't have nutrition at the top of the list. It's just a matter of, hey, you know, we have X number of dollars that are available as bids submit a bid, you get the bid, and then you find out that lunch consists of French fries,
right,
and a greasy burger and with, you know, awful bread and Jell-O for dessert.
Right.
That is not nutrition. It's not nutrition. So, I mean, I don't know how much, to what degree that affects what your child gets to eat or the children in your child's school gets to eat, but you have an extraordinarily strong point, Flori, about the relationship between what children are eating and possible discipline problems in the classroom. That's a very good connection. Thank you so much for joining
us. Sure, Yatri. Thanks to you.
Thank you. Michael from New Jersey. Hello. You're on the air, Michael.
I wanted to go back to the sequester that they let go through it. You know, I was on your show some time ago, and I predicted that they would let the sequester go through. Not that I'm a great predictor, anybody could have. But they also said that, that I thought that they had a plan, not Democrat or Republican, but, you know, the powers that be in Washington, that make policy, had a plan, and they were going to ram it down our throat as a consequence of the sequester going through, and really propagandizing the sequester as something terrible, and we have to accept something else, and they're going to make us accept something else. And I think it's coming down to a unique and terrible precedent that they're going to chop into the social programs, and I think this is the beginning. They think if we can get a start, if we can just break that first time, you know, make them give up something in Social Security, and it's not the first time. I believe there were other instances, but this seems like a precedent that they're really going to chip away at the safety net in America. And it goes along with who's in charge and the rise of the corporations and the demise of the people, I'm afraid.
But, you know, I don't know. I would disagree a bit with you, Michael, because mm-hmm. this is not a precedent at all.
No,
don't forget,
the
chipping away began with Clinton in recent memory. It was Clinton's administration. I keep pointing to that. Clinton was the point man for dismantling the, as he says, we will change welfare as we know it. And it came to mean the whole picture of social programs. That was to be the hallmark, and it was the hallmark of the Clinton administration, because in laying, you know, a heavy axe at these programs, he was able to leave office, and he still boasts about the fact that he had an unprecedented, if the word is to be used, an unprecedented surplus.
Yes, and he decided to chip away at the safety net at that point. And I have to agree with your argument. I mean, it's not a unique and terrible precedent. It's another iteration of something that's been going on. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans in there. Ronald Reagan starts it, and as you say, Clinton continues in another fashion. And what it is basically that people don't have any leverage of power whatsoever, and if they have to join a group to gain numbers, to gain power, to have influence, of course, then they're attacked like the 99%ers, and there's just a fragmentation. And it's something about what's been set up as government. It's opaque. They let you see what they want you to see, but they redact what they don't want you to see. And you know, when there's a like a WikiLeaks or somebody, you know, lets out information, it's like it's a terrible thing, and you know, they go after those people mercilessly. So there's no transparency, and they're kind of like, you know, when I was in college, I didn't want to join a sorority or a fraternity because I felt like I was giving up my independence. And if you join a sorority, fraternity in my case, you give up your independence, but you get certain benefits from it. You get party and beer and whatever they have there.
You get green beer for St. Patrick's Day.
So, but it's not different when you say you're joining another kind of group that's gonna gain influence and power and have influence in Washington. I mean, like you mentioned, the Black Caucus. Do they have influence at this point?
Nope.
It's declining and declining and declining because they're not paying. The corporations are paying, and they're getting what they pay for. And
but, you know, let me ask you, Michael, because I think you're on top of something here.
I'm sorry?
I think you're on top of something here. I just wanted you to see, in fact, you're on a very heavy point. And I want to use the word unprecedented as the cue for me. There is something unprecedented occurring in the Obama administration. And it has to do with the pervasiveness of the application of a particular kind of philosophy that is being enacted in pervasive ways in all these major areas, in education, healthcare, and the like. But what is precedent setting, I think, with Obama is the ideological twist. It is being made to look like it's a Democratic Party, but it ain't a Democratic Party.
Right. In a sense, I agree with the first caller you had on, where she said that there are distracting issues out there. And in a sense, you know, I kind of agree with her. Even something as serious as the gun issue, which I have feelings about too. Why do people need guns? And you know what, you know, the whole idea of it. But at this point, these are kind of issues that say, yeah, we're Democrats. We've, you know, we're for gun control
I think you have two parties that are actually two different wings of the same flightless bird. You have the Republicans and the Democrats with very little to distinguish between them as ideological differences. Barack Obama's version of what the Democratic Party stands for is very much in line with what the Republican Party says it stands for.
Right. And there's no real commitment to values. So they're basically purchased by the highest bidder. And because, you know, I mean, they squibble and squabble and they block each other's paths. And so it kind of weakens both parties. It kind of dilutes completely any kind of, you know, values or issues that come up. And it always turns back to the economic value of it. Even during the war, they were talking about how much it cost. I mean, you're talking about killing people, but they want to know how much it's going to cost. We might not want to kill these people. It might cost so much.
In fact, that's the truth. I mean, is a war, you know, if a war is going to cost a lot more, it's all the more reason. Like we now, you know, we've been clanging against Iran and against North Korea. Those are very good wars from the point of view of the war complex. They can make a lot of money. I'm not kidding. I mean, this is serious. As opposed to what they call the police action in Grenada. That is a little thing. But you want to, if you're going to go to war, it's got to be big now, because that really gets the economy going.
Yes,
in the middle
industry.
Of all of this, if we can have a really great, glorious war, that's what this country needs.
Right. Set everybody right.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
So much for your call today. Eric from Brooklyn, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, I love your show, Utrice. Thank you very much.
Me too. I love this show.
your last discussion leads exactly into what I wanted to talk about. And that is that, you know, I feel like the Democrats are the most destructive and dangerous party. And this is why. The Democrats have this capability. They're supposedly the party of the people. they're supposedly the ones that want to make everything better, that care, that have any kind of morality. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Yeah, but they're the more psychopathic, you know, party, because the Republicans always tell you what they want to do. They tell you what they're going to do, and they tell you it's for their constituents. They tell you it's for the wealthy, for the military, for the corporations, and you just have to deal with it. If you're not on board with that, then that's your problem. So they make it very clear. It's the Democrats. When you get a good dose of the Bushes, the Reagans, you know, the elder Bushes, you had the Clintons come in, and they're so smooth that, you know, you have a population that's on the verge of just saying, you know, to hell with this. We don't want this. This is not working in any kind of way. And then you get the dangerous crowd, the ones that appease you, the ones that you know, rub your shoulders and calm you down. Now, settle down. Let's continue with the same agenda. Let's just tone it down, you know. And they come in and they make sure that the masses, you know, are deceived. They make sure that these people that don't have, you know, such a great analytical ability, you know, they make sure that those people are fooled into, you know, settling back down and working as hard as they've been working and struggling. And you know, the crazy thing is they force all these people to act like they don't see what they're seeing, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why they're more dangerous. You have a president that's, you know, slaughtering people on a massive level. And you have Michael Eric Dyson, who you played yesterday, who tells you what these people are doing. Who tells you what this president has been doing, you know, 3 years ago. But when he was asked on the Black and Gender Report, after saying all of that, when he was asked by the host, who are you voting for? He said Obama. You know, he still said Obama. I'm going to vote for Obama, but I'm going to hold my nose. Or some crazy stuff. You know, so if you have people that are that influential, that won't dare to say, forget it. These two parties, none of them are good. And actually, the ones that say they're good are the worst. You know, let's go with something else. And there has to be a beginning. But these people won't dare to say that. At the end of the day, they always fall back, regardless of any kind of evil they see.
Where is the beginning, you see, right now? This is an appropriate time to begin something new, you think?
Oh, man. I mean, a long time ago was appropriate. But what if you begin by not co-signing what these people are doing? Don't vote for them. I mean, don't vote for Obama. Don't vote for Romney. Don't vote for Democrat. Don't vote. You know, because even all the Democrats that are all in that party, why are you still a Democrat? If you say that you have any kind of morals, you're sitting alongside, even the Black Caucus or whatever, you're sitting alongside this highly destructive force in this world, you know? And we're supposed to look at you as if you're different. You're going along with all of it, just as bad as the ones that are actually doing it, because you're a part of it. You call yourself this evil entity.
But,
you know,
Eric,
yes.
The vote, we have been conditioned for so many years. The vote is so important. So many people died for the right to vote. And here you are, Eric. You're talking about not voting. What is the matter with
you? I'm not talking about not voting. I'm saying don't vote. Like me, I voted for Jill Stein. Vote for somebody that has something to say. You
okay.
Have Obama and Romney in the debates, excluding everybody else, and they're saying, oh, I agree with you, but tweak it a little bit. I agree with you, but tweak it a little bit. I mean, and we can't see that joke.
Well, you know, frankly, to be very honest, I had a couple of years ago, I actually startled some people I was talking to. I was giving a talk, and I said, mm-hmm. It would be incredibly powerful if Black people just did not vote at all, given the choices at the time. It didn't seem to make sense to vote. And that, too, should be an option.
Oh, that should be an option. But there are people in this last election that were willing to say what needed to be said. You know, there are people that were giving you examples of how they could do things differently. You know, so if we're going to go vote, Like you said, people died so that we could vote. If we're going to go vote, at least vote for somebody that's saying something positive. You know, we're debating who's the most destructive power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, they're just terrorizing us. And I mean, you know, life is getting so hard. You know, so it's just amazing. People are acting like they don't see what they see. You know, people are acting like there's some kind of, and it's this idea, this ability to live in this illusion that you create, that they've created for you.
Well, yes, but then you have this information machine that presses the point and keeps the illusion very much alive. You know, when you look at these Sunday programs and you say, that's the best these folks could do in asking some questions. This is it for public service programming. This is what people, they're pushing. You know, like they literally are pushing Hillary Clinton right now as the next president. You know, all the reports, they've begun the mental attack. She's got to be president, you know?
Well, so, like you said, this stress on people is actually, it could be a positive thing, I think. It could be positive. Let them lose their social security. Let them lose their education. Let them lose their student loans. Let them lose their bank accounts. If that's what it takes for them to wake up, then it should happen. It should happen now. It should happen before there's the capability to just completely destroy all of us. You know?
I'll tell you what, Eric.
A few of us that will resist.
You have my vote. Thank you, Eric, for being with us. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I'm glad. I'm delighted that there's such vigorous participation because this is important. We have to feel comfortable with the idea of sharing our points of view. It's immaterial whether people agree or disagree. It is important only that you can course us through the journey that you made toward your point of view or opinion. And that is great work. This is great work. So I want to thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company, for feeling safe enough on this program to express yourself and your intimate thoughts. And this process will help us all in refocusing our thinking about things. We had so many different points raised today. So we have a lot to consider. Some of these programs some of these thoughts will evolve into programs, and you'll be able to recognize them because I will certainly credit the idea person with the program. So thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Stay tuned. You want to stay tuned. Why? Because Richard Wolff is up next with Wake Up Call. Is it Wake Up Call? Yes. And we'll see each other tomorrow. And tell a friend and grow this family. Bye-bye.